go back to Italy. Meredith's brother Lyle says if Knox's appeal fails, then there's no reason why she won't be sent there.
If a country such as the US didn't choose to go along with laws that they themselves uphold when extraditing, you know, convicted criminals from other countries, it probably leaves them in a strange position not to.
Actress Sienna Miller has admitted being briefly involved with Daniel Craig, but giving evidence via video link at the phone hacking trial, she said an allegedly hacked voicemail she left for the Bond actor saying, "I love you," was something she said to all her friends. Our reporter Tom Parmenter is at the Old Bailey.
Timothy Langdale, QC4, Andy Coulson, said to her, "Do you think that the message itself could have been the basis of a story for a journalist?" Well, she said, "Well, it's not up to me to decide whether or not it's a story, but certainly, yes, for a journalist, it may have seemed titillating."
The former News of the World editor, Mr. Coulson, and six others deny the charges. Up to 100 people could be made redundant from the Bank of England. It follows what it's calling a value for money review. There are more than 130 flood warnings in place across Britain. Six of them are rated as severe. Football, and there are 6 hours remaining in the January transfer window. The biggest deals done so far today, as far as how much money has been spent, are Chelsea signing defender Kurt Zouma from St Etienne, while Fulham have brought in Greece striker Konstantinos Mitroglou from Olympiacos. Fulham have also loaned Lewis Holtby from Tottenham. Wilfred Zaha has moved on loan from Manchester United to Cardiff, with Fabio following suit on a permanent basis. And Andy Flower's tenure at the helm of the England cricket side is at an end. Following a disastrous Winter Ashes tour, he's stood down from his role as team director. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Helping us review this week's news is the chair of Bristol City Council's Resources Scrutiny Committee, Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. After the 6 o'clock news, the Royal Bank of Scotland, despite being owned and controlled, supposedly, by the Treasury, that's us, is killing off healthy British businesses to boost its own profits. Plus, Monday was Holocaust Memorial Day. We hear about a new parliamentary Holocaust commission and look at links, whistleblower Edward Snowden's revelations that NATO governments are committing criminal offences, compiling massive databases on every single one of us. Everybody's now an NSA and GCHQ subject, and it's all happening behind the veil of so-called national security. Plus, carried over from last week, former US Marine Ken O'Keefe takes in what really happened on the 9/11 attacks, gives us his view. Is another investigation in that day going to help? If not, what is? Plus, Martin Summers will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 Celsius, some heavy showers and windy. This weekend, highs of 7, cloudier, windier, and some light showers on Saturday, sunnier and calmer on Sunday. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, sunshine and showers through the week, and windy at times. Next weekend, 8th and 9th of February, highs of 9 Celsius, wet and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Chair of Bristol City Council's Resources Scrutiny Committee, Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi.
First of all, tell us about your scrutiny committee. What are you scrutinising and why?
Well, basically, we look at the council's spending. Is it wise? Could it be done better, more efficiently? And obviously, over the last couple of months, we've actually been trying to look at the council budget that's been brought forward.
Well, you say trying. Has it not been that easy then?
It's not been provided at the right time, and it's not being as complete as it should be. There's been quite a lot of generalities there, and in actual fact quite a number of erroneous assumptions were actually made. But we've made some progress with it, and we feel there's quite a lot more that can be done.
Now, I know it's around about £500 million that you spend every year at the council on us, hopefully mostly on services. But what about cuts? How much of that is going to be cuts this year? I think, isn't it, £90 million over 3 years? So I'm guessing around about £30 million of cuts coming out of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things. There's one which is genuine efficiencies, and actually over the last 2 or 3 years the council has more or less managed to do that without there being a huge impact on frontline services like libraries closing, toilets closing and that sort of thing, and there are genuine things which get people really upset, like libraries closing, like no money available for planting trees, etc. And then the proposals that came forward a couple of months ago, there was rather too much in the way of serious frontline service cuts that would have hurt rather a lot. And I think now that when the budget has been examined in a bit more detail and been done rather more efficiently than it was at the beginning, that quite a number of those have been avoided, and some of us feel that a few more can be avoided as well. I think that the general public accept that the council's got to do things more efficiently, so do the same job but with spending less money. But what they're very concerned about is when, instead of working hard to do that, there's a casual cutting of a frontline service.
So how does the process work from Mayor Ferguson, Lord Ferguson, presenting everybody with the budget, and then it goes through a whole process, and eventually it's chiselled away, bits are chiselled away here and there, maybe new money is found, and then finally, I think it's in the middle of February, isn't it? You finalise the budget.
It's the 18th of February that the council hopefully will agree the final budget. Although if there's not agreement, which is quite possible on this occasion, there might have to be a second meeting, you know, where there's an adjournment and come back.
But what about that process? I mean, because obviously you take a part of that. You're doing resources scrutiny, Gary, you know, so you're a part of looking at that original budget and actually fine-tuning it by the time we get to middle of February.
Yes. We don't have the power to change things. What we do have the power to do is to expose things where we have the information to work with, to say, hang on, you've made an assumption there about how many houses that we'll have in Bristol next year, which we think is actually wrong. We think there's more being built than that, and therefore you'll be collecting more council tax in than that. So, and we actually look at, hang on, we think you've got more in reserves than you're actually saying there, so we want you to use that money rather than cutting a service instead. So we pick away at some of the details to expose them, and then the political parties will come along and say, well, actually, given that information, we want this changed or that changed.
Now, I know one of the things that you've said is that it may be that the mayor doesn't need to make the amount of cuts that he does. He's proposing, because actually one of the things he's doing is he's trying to increase the council's reserves, which may not be the best time to do that at a time when the services are very much needed.
Absolutely, that's the case. The general reserves in the council at the moment are about £6 million, which doesn't sound very much. But actually, Bristol City Council has more in terms of earmarked reserves, so for specific things that may go wrong in all sorts of departments spread all over the place, that when you put them together and examine them in a degree of detail, actually mean that the level of reserves is perfectly sufficient at the moment. So you don't need to be taking extra money in council tax from people to put into reserve pot.
Well, why do we need reserves anyway? Surely, I mean, at the moment, we're trying to provide services, I mean, for example, for elderly people, saying these sorts of services, home care, this kind of thing. We need to be making sure that all those services are provided. The money isn't just sitting in a bank account just in case it might be needed.
You do need a level of reserves. I mean, for example, I remember when I was dealing with transport 2 or 3 years ago, we had a sudden problem with the Bridge Valley Road falling to pieces. You know, it was a lot of money to deal with it, a couple of million pounds. We couldn't have foreseen that. If we didn't have the couple of million pounds available, we couldn't have fixed the road. So you do need a small amount, but it shouldn't be any more than is absolutely necessary.
So let's get this clear. Is Ferguson preparing to increase increase these earmark reserves, or is it some sort of separate reserves?
He is saying that there isn't enough in reserves, and he's saying that he needs to increase dramatically, more than triple, in fact, the general reserve. And what we're actually saying is, if you take into account all the earmark reserves and take proper account of them, you do not need to increase the general reserve by nearly that much.
Also, I know that you've been looking at some quite positive news coming out of the buses. Tell us about that, because there's been some quite big increases in the amount of people using the buses in the city.
Yeah, when you invest in something like transport systems, you don't get the results immediately, you know, next week, next month, or even next year. Sometimes it takes time to filter through, and there's an ongoing effect. And if you get it into a virtuous circle situation where the right things are happening, success breeds success. What we had in Bristol for many years is a vicious circle: higher and higher fares, less and less people using the services, general hatred of the bus company, which really didn't help anybody. So what has actually happened with the investment in the new route, which was new bus routes, which was paid for by central government, the new bus stops, the real-time information system, that whole structure, has actually meant that bus usage has gone up quite dramatically, in some cases by over 40% on the individual main bus routes, which actually meant that First Bus in Bristol operation, from being one of the least successful in the country, suddenly was producing very sizable profits, which directly led to them actually cutting their fares, because as well as them actually having more revenue coming in, they were getting more competition, because Wessex in particular and other companies are coming in and running services at cheaper rates than them.
But don't you ever harken back to the old days, Gary? I'm not sure if you were in Bristol at the time with the Bristol Corporation buses. That extra revenue would be coming back into the council's budget, wouldn't it?
Well, in actual fact, I am in favour of the council having far more control, not to actually run the services, because we didn't actually do a very good job.
So you prefer the money to go to shareholders, would you, or to pay off debts?
No, the way it should
happen. I mean, First Group have got a massive debt, haven't they? They're the parent company in the States that they're trying to service.
They certainly have. And in actual fact, a lot of the money that they're making in Bristol is subsidising less successful operations in different parts of the country. So, yes, we are concerned about that. And we actually proposed in our manifesto for the mayor election that, and actually it was rejected by the other parties, that we should go for quality bus contracts. And what that means is you franchise out individual routes, and instead of handing out subsidies on the few loss-making routes, you make certain that money stays in Bristol for the benefit of the passengers in Bristol.
But it's not. These extra profits that's going to First Group, it's not staying in Bristol,
is it?
Well,
they are at the moment.
No, they're not. It's going to the shareholders.
Quality bus contracts, which takes far more control of what actually happens, means that the money stays in Bristol.
I'm not complaining about the buses doing well. I just wish that the money was actually staying in the city now and not going to service debts of First Group.
And when we said that we should be taking far more control of the bus company and how they actually operate, the other party said, oh, it's too risky. We're losing lots of money in Bristol. It could cost the taxpayer money. We're just seeing now the vast profits that First are actually making, and therefore those profits, far more of them, should be channeled back into Bristol.
Can you put a figure on what they're making in Bristol?
They're making a return on capital. In the last measurement that we've actually got, is 17.7% operating profit.
But we don't know how much that is in cash.
Oh, that can easily be found out.
Okay, we'll have to see if we can work that one out.
Yeah, but it is lots of millions of pounds, basically.
Which could certainly help the mayor with his budget. So why not Bristol owning buses? What's the problem you have with that? Is it just impractical to change back over to a municipal bus company?
That has too many complications. But what we're proposing is effectively partway towards that, where the operators operate the services, but we say what fares they're allowed to charge, so we keep the fares down. And we also say, if you want to run buses on that route, you've got to pay a certain amount of the profit towards the overall city transport structure, which means that for some of those other routes, which don't make a huge profit, that those can be run without having to dig into the taxpayers' funds.
Okay, back to the budget, though. The council are saying that there's going to be probably 800 full-time job cuts. To what extent would not spending so much money, or not putting so much money into these reserves, actually be able to save some of those jobs, Gary?
Well,
I mean, with all those jobs comes a service, doesn't it?
There will be cuts in jobs. I mean, you know, that can't be avoided.
But 800 is a massive number.
And actually, we are concerned about the way this is actually being done. Because we had a steady state for 2 or 3 years where there were reductions in jobs, but it was done by what's called natural wastage. Not a nice phrase, I know. But what it meant was we didn't sack people. We just, as people left, we didn't replace them. Saved lots of money on redundancies, and it was a slow and steady process of reducing numbers, and you actually don't have huge costs involved in it. What actually happened was the mayor went to sleep for almost a year on this process. Then a new chief officer came in and said, "You're behind on here, you need to do this." And trying to do it very quickly means that you're forced to have far more redundancy payments, and you have compulsory redundancies, which are not helpful and are more costly. So basically, what's happened is it's been, you know, things haven't been progressed in the way that they should have been for a while, and now they're having to be done in a huge rush, and that's costly. And it also means that there's a potential disruption in terms of the way that a number of the departments actually run. You do need to change people, you do need to reduce the total number, but whole departments going completely leads to disruption of service.
Now, she's been in for nearly a year. Nicola Yates, how's she getting on as chief executive?
Nicola is very efficient, has huge respect from the staff, and knows what she's about.
Okay, so that's very, very diplomatic. I mean, she's landed in from, I think it was up north somewhere, wasn't it? I just wonder if you found that she's actually hit the ground running, and because it surely must take at least a year to really get your head around how the workings of an individual city council.
I think she came in an extremely difficult situation.
I mean, she's responsible for that budget, 500 million or so.
She came in an extremely difficult situation where basically, for the last few months when Liberal Democrats were in charge, it was quite difficult to bring the right sort of staff in because there was uncertainty with the mayor system coming along. The mayor said he didn't need a chief executive, which he did. And basically there was a gap of quite some while where there was lots of press releases coming out, but nothing structurally happening.
So how was the mayor proposing to deal with things without having a full-time chief executive officer running the day-to-day budget, or, you know, the council day-to-day?
Well, it's a very good question, and we saw how he managed, and basically things just didn't get done and things weren't organised, and there was unfortunately a lot of talk but very little action.
Okay, but she's doing okay now. This 500 million, though, Gary, just give us finally on
but
the
budget. She's having to catch up
on the budget. What are the things that you think from the original proposals back in November? I think it was last year. What are we going to be saving, do you think, if it's at all possible?
Well, I mean, the mayor's actually had to withdraw quite a number of the proposals. Some of the silly ones, like closing Hengrove Play Park. Well, he claims he wouldn't have closed it, but it would have been closed.
Do you think, to a certain extent, that some of these things are put in there as a sort of bargaining chip, and then he could be seen to be, oh, yes, I'm listening and I'm getting rid of these things? Or was he serious about doing this?
What a cynical, for example, thing to say, yes.
what about, for example, closing the toilets? I mean, this is an appalling decision, particularly for elderly people. You know, how on earth can elderly people be walking around if there are no public toilets around for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think they just showed the lack of experience, because it is actually true that in some cases you can replace public toilets with somewhat better provision from, you know, a next door supermarket or something along those. That can be done in some cases, but it takes time and it takes effort, and to actually have, we're closing all of them and they're all going to close within a few months, was just totally unrealistic and stupid.
Okay, Old Abe Oxford economist Martin Summers, just get your take on the way that this budget process works, because these cuts, which we're facing in Bristol, it's going to be around about £25 million a year. We heard originally £90 million over 3 years, now it's £83 million over 3 years. And also, the reserves are being increased. So that's actually going to make the cuts even worse in the city by George Ferguson. We must get him in before the election anyway to get him explain some of this. What about the situation generally? I mean, surely the council doesn't have actually a lot of choice. They're just told what to do by Westminster.
Effectively, that's the case. I don't think that local government should be making cuts in general. And in actual fact, if you look at the way the standard spending assessments have been rigged by central government, it is, in fact, the most deprived parts of Britain which are actually having to make the most cuts.
Ho ho, that's usually Labour voting areas, isn't
it? Well, it's certainly inner cities up north are taking the brunt of the attack, and the leafy shires are being protected. And having said that, of course, we've got a coalition of all the parties running Bristol, supposedly in cooperation with Mayor Ferguson, and you've got to do what you've got to do, and therefore you're looking for wriggle room and sensible decisions and so forth within the constraints that we're in. But I think we still need to be saying, because local government is having to take the strain for the government, the central government's cuts policy. Local government has been targeted as the place where all these cuts have got to be made, and I think it's really wrong and silly, basically.
Gary, the cabinet, I mean, I know, I'm not quite sure to what extent the Mayor's Cabinet really has much of a say. We've got, for the Conservatives, Councillor Jeff Gollop. We've got Mark Bradshaw, who's sadly been taken ill in the last few weeks. For the Labour Party, we've got Simon Cook for your party and Gus Hoyt for the Greens. How much say do they actually have as part of that cabinet?
Practically none. Basically, the Mayor makes all the decisions. It's possible in some cases he takes advice on certain...
So what are they there for?
I think the Mayor must answer that, because, I mean, we've had one or two members of the so-called Cabinet along for scrutiny meetings, and, you know, as soon as it gets to a difficult question, well, you need to ask George that, because he makes the decision. And, you know, I had one example, I won't say which particular executive member, but he actually found out about something affecting his own area of responsibility from some papers that have been put in front of us. Incidentally, some weeks later, he said, good grief.
Exactly in the know, really, are they?
Well, not really, no.
And I wonder whether you've got a sort of situation where they're sort of told by the Mayor, this is the policy, and then they just sort of then communicate that with the parties, and they don't get much of a say. Doesn't seem that there's much of a point of having these people in the Cabinet, if that's the case.
Well, I mean... The fact is that the Mayor starts off with all the power, or the vast majority of it. In some cases, mayors devolve power to people within a cabinet or to other people. In this case, in Bristol, he's chosen not to.
Okay, that's a bit of a pity. Anyway, let's get on to look at some of the stories this week. We'll start with a local one. Homophobic comments over Sir Ian McKellen come back to haunt Bristol Tories. This is in the Bristol Post. The Greens are refusing to support the Tories' nomination for Bristol's next Lord Mayor following a row about alleged homophobia. City Council's Conservative group is understood to be set to nominate Chris Windows for the honorary role, which is rotated between the political parties in turn each year. The Greens have announced that they will not give their backing to Mr. Windows because of comments he made in 2011 about gay activist Sir Ian McKellen, which led him to be accused of homophobia by another councillor. What do you make of this, Gary?
I think Councillor Windows will have to work extremely hard to get support from any of the other parties.
We've heard about the Greens. What's the Lib Dems' position?
As I just said, he'll have to work extremely hard if he wants to get our support.
So every year, a different party chooses who they want to be the Lord Mayor. What's the deadline for this? When have they got to actually, when does the old, I shouldn't say old, the previous Lord Mayor, when does he finish in his term?
Well, I mean, the actual handover is in May, towards the end of May, but things need to be organised some way in advance of that, because the new person who's taking over needs to be bedded in, shown what to do and that sort of thing. So basically, should we say, discussions are taking place.
Well, what Chris Windows is accused of here, apparently has said, is that the Henbury Ward councillor, that's what Chris Windows, said at a city council meeting, Martin, that he was unhappy and disturbed that local schools had been visited by Lord of the Rings and X-Men star Sir Ian on behalf of gay rights group Stonewall.
Well, I don't know what the Labour Party's official position is on this, but I would echo what has just been said. He'll have some difficulty getting support from the different political parties if he's going to take controversial views like that on Sir Ian McKellen.
Now, it's not the only time Ian McKellen has been in the news. I'm not sure. I actually don't know if he's a local person or not. But Bristol MP Kerry McCarthy has called for Ian McKellen again, popping up. Obviously, everyone's watched The Hobbit over Christmas and decided this is a good strap line for the next news story. To promote equal rights at Russia's Winter Olympics, Kerry McCarthy's calling for. She's calling for Sir Ian McKellen to join Britain's delegation to the Winter Olympics in Russia to promote equal rights. The Labour MP for Bristol East has suggested the gay actor accompanying the likes of diver Tom Daley and TV presenter Claire Balding in the delegation to protest at Russian President Vladimir Putin's introduction of laws banning homosexual propaganda. Gary?
Well, I mean, it's not going to happen, is it? And basically, under the guise of banning propaganda, the gay rights in Russia really don't exist. Yeah, I think the only thing that can be said is there are some parts of the world which are even worse.
Well, I mean, I, for example, was watching something on Russia Today where they showed what gay clubs are like. They're not closed down by the police. They're just very discreet and out of the way in Russian cities. Mm. Martin.
Well, let's. I mean, what's being? It's not Vladimir Putin's law. It's actually the Russian Duma's law. It's very similar to Clause 28. Was it in Britain? Basically, so, you know, teachers were not allowed to talk about gay rights and so on. I would be opposed to that. But Russia, in fact, is very similar to certain parts of the United States of America in having a conservative culture and so on. And of course, Qatar, where we're going to have the football, don't have any gay rights at all. So is Ian McKellen going to go there? Or perhaps, you know, there's an element of Russia and the West, you know, finding things to fight about here. And we don't need to find things to fight about with them.
Okay, let's go up to Birmingham. It's not very far away, is it? Just up the M5. Police accused of kettling student protesters in a national demonstration in Birmingham yesterday. 14 people were arrested at a national student protest at the University of Birmingham after around 150 people occupied campus buildings and clashed with security guards. Students accused police of holding protesters in a kettle for 4 hours with no access to food, water or toilets before making arrests for offences including aggravated trespass on their own campus, assaulted and criminal damage. The police deny kettling any lawful protest. Gary, I mean, this follows on from a few weeks ago when a similar kind of thing happened in London, didn't it? It was a student demonstration in London, which was actually quite peaceful, but the police decided they were going to close it down.
I think that it's interesting to look around the different tactics used by the police in different parts of the country. And some seem to manage to successfully encourage peaceful protest, others don't. I think that, I don't know enough about the detail here to say this was done right or wrong. I haven't seen it. I'm seeing a report which doesn't necessarily tell me exactly what happened.
Martin, the demonstration is led by Defend Education Birmingham, and it was campaigning against the marketisation of higher education, including the living wage for university staff and the highest lowest pay ratio of 10-1. So this isn't just about the students protesting about their own situation around the country. They're also saying, well, what about the staff that are working at these universities? They're also being paid peanuts.
Well, that was what the protest in London was about at London University, which had a similar effect. And there was also, I think that's what Sussex University had a similar face-off. I think what's worrying about this is that university authorities, as universities become more business-oriented, they seem to be taking the view that what would be regarded in the past as, you know, student activism of a fairly straightforward kind is being criminalised by university authorities because they don't want their universities to get a reputation or to be seen in the media as places where protests and so on take place. And I remember, for example, when George Galloway came to talk at Bristol Student Union in Bristol University years ago, they were saying we can't have him speaking in the student union because that would be political and then we might get bad publicity from it. And Galloway just said to them, look, you know, you are a university, probably, you know, one of the best universities in the country. What's that down the road there? It's called a politics department. And we're starting to get a depoliticisation. the idea that students are not to be political. And the university authorities around the country seem to be taking this kind of
it
view.
It seems to me something a bit strange about trespassing on your own university campus when you're
well. In the past, people would have just if they're occupying whatever it is, then they do it, and the university authorities wouldn't necessarily bring in the police to clear people off.
Hattie Craig, who's an officer at Birmingham's Guild of Students, said that some students she represents claimed they were dragged to the floor by private security guards by their hair whilst shouting, "I'm peaceful, don't hurt me." Other students have their alleged that they were assaulted by members of the private security company. A national week of action is being planned for the 6th to the 13th of February. Take note. So, this is from something called the Bromsgrove Standard. This is a little paper we don't have on here very often. From a similar part of the country, that's, I think, Worcestershire. Conservatives deny county poverty crisis despite food bank figures. Now, I read this, I found it quite staggering, that the figures show in a matter of months that the number of registered food banks in Worcestershire has almost tripled. An estimated 46,000 adults and 20,000 children went hungry over Christmas in England, the figure tripling from last year. Amount of people using food banks is 12 times more than it was in 2010. Also, they're actually saying, Gary, that the figures of numbers of people helped by food banks in 2014 could top a million.
Well, I think when the government are actually looking at trying to balance the books up, it's exactly true that the highest top 20% are actually had the most significant drop in their take-home pay, as it were. But in actual fact, for them, they can afford it. When you're at the bottom of the scale, a very tiny difference can make, can tip you over the edge. I mean, it's one reason why we want to freeze the council tax in Bristol rather than put it up. And it's one reason why, with the Labour Party, we said to George Ferguson, "I'm sorry, it is pointless sending out council tax bills to people on very low income. We want the support scheme extended." I think with regard to the food banks, there is a significant increase in the number of people who have significant problems. But as well as that, I think what's also happened is that people who would have shunned away from using a food bank now think, well, actually, there's lots of other people doing it. It's okay. So there is a combination of the actual financial pressure being increased on more people, and also people feeling it is something that I can use.
Well, just before Christmas, we had a representative, didn't we, from the Matthew Trust on here, and he was saying that actually what's happening is that these food banks, and he runs a food store, are actually becoming almost a support network in themselves, that people are actually feel broken because they cannot feed their family, they cannot feed themselves, whatever benefits are being taken away, sanctions being applied to them wrongly, in many cases, and that these places are actually acting as a kind of safety net as well, Martin, in a sort of psychological, in a social way. But, I mean, what's happening up in Worcestershire is that the Conservatives are denying that there is a poverty crisis. Conservative Councillor John Campion said, "I don't agree that there is a crisis within the country of poverty. We are seeing the economy growing, we are seeing more people in work, and we are seeing the economy recover. Those are the facts."
Well, what can I say about this? I mean, what's the chap from the Matthew Trust was saying is that people don't just turn up at food banks. That's the main point he was stressing. You've got to be referred. So in actual fact, they're referred by addiction agencies, by the job centres and so on. They don't just turn up. You can't just turn up. I mean, the Wild Goose Cafe up on Stapleton Road, I think that is all comers. And I think the stigma of taking free food has gone, as Gary suggested, because people are struggling at the bottom. And I think a lot of this is actually not so much to do with the economy, but to do with welfare reforms. The economy it's still, in my view, not where it ought to be. But I don't think that's the fundamental problem. I think what has happened is a punitive attitude has been taken to people on benefits, including, don't forget, most people on benefits are working. That's often forgotten. And we've seen that, rather shocking programme on Channel 4 the benefit streets, basically picking on a small minority of people even in the street and making them into national pariahs. I think it's a very nasty sort of attitude developing. We're turning into a very divided society, and I hope the people who are pushing this from the top aren't going to complain when the bricks and bottles come flying from the bottom, because they will.
I think one thing with regard to the benefit, which is very important actually, and I think the food bank managers will confirm quite a bit of this, a lot of it is actually down to the sheer inefficiency of the DWP in terms of providing the benefit. People who, you know, they haven't got any spare money at all, if suddenly find out that the benefit they're entitled to doesn't get paid because of incompetence and inefficiency, and they don't have the resources to get it put right quickly, in some cases that can tip people completely over the edge.
Well, they're not the only people that are pleading poverty, are they? People are going to food banks because the Queen's been doing it this week. But we'll leave that one for a moment because there's another story. Three people were charged with stealing food from a skip behind Iceland supermarket this week, and then the Crown Prosecution Service quickly backtracked. The spokespeople from Iceland said, well, actually the police and the media, the BBC, were wrong to say that this was £30 worth of food. It was nothing's worth of food. It was thrown away, even though the police returned the items to the Iceland store afterwards. Of course, the Iceland store people then just put them straight in the bin, Gary.
Absolutely stupid.
Waste of police time and money, isn't it, if we're talking about saving money?
But what are police doing? Arresting people for... Apparently they were originally arrested for burglary, which is actually... it's not just theft, is it, burglary? It's when you're actually physically menacing somebody.
As I understand it, they climbed over the wall.
Were they physically menacing a bin?
No, they climbed over the wall into the back of Iceland, and therefore people phoned up and said the people climbing into Iceland. Therefore, I imagine the local coppers presumed, oh, well, we've got a complaint here. These people were climbing over the wall. Generally the police respond to people making complaints.
But this actually got as far as them being charged, and the Crown Prosecution saying it was in the public interest to charge these people and convict them if possible.
Well, that was silly, wasn't it?
Okay, well, anyway, back over to the other end of the spectrum, that is the super multimillionaires, and the 50p rate of tax was discussed this week at Prime Minister's Questions in Westminster between Ed Miliband and Prime Minister David Cameron.
What we have is a policy with the overwhelming support of the most important people of all, the people of Britain. That is what the 50p is. And he's obviously rather coy in telling us who said it. Well, of course, Mr. Speaker, it was him in 2009, just before the election. It was him that said the 50p tax rate was a symbol of us all being in it together, and now it's gone. Now can he tell us whether he rules out cutting the top rate further to 40p?
The Chancellor set out yesterday exactly what our priorities are. We want to cut taxes for the lowest paid and for middle income people. I'm not surprised he didn't hear the Chancellor, because like the rest of the Labour Party, he wasn't here yesterday. While we're on the subject of interesting quotes, who in the last 48 hours said this? Do I think the level of public spending going into the crisis was a problem for Britain? No, I don't, nor our deficit, nor our national debt. In fact, he even said in some areas we would spend more. That is the Shadow Chancellor.
Well, that's the usual shouting match at question time. We have it every week. There was quite a nice one just after Christmas, wasn't there? They were quite nice to each other. They were back to normal
now. Very cosy, like they were around the Christmas, yes. Eating mince pies or something around the fire. But there's some serious points being made there. One is about this 50p rate of tax. Ed Miliband saying to David Cameron, hang on a minute, you said that this was set in stone and you've got rid of it. What about changing that now?
Well, I think what's happening is that we're getting manoeuvring in relation to the next general election. I'll be interested to hear from Gary what his view on the 50p tax rate is. I mean, in the 1950s, when the Korean War was at its height, the top rate of tax in Britain was something like 96%. And people say, and it was 80-something percent throughout the Thatcher era. And I didn't notice all of these people packing their bags and fleeing to Russia during the Thatcher era because the tax rate was too high. We've got used to the idea now, and the wealthy have got used to the idea that they don't have to pay. And that, of course, causes fundamental problems when we come to talk about things like food banks.
Gary?
Yeah, well, there was furious rows within the coalition about this. Basically, I mean, but the hypocrisy that's been going around is absolutely staggering. I mean, we had a 40% tax rate, top tax rate, for all but the last 6 weeks of the previous previous Labour government.
Well, that's, yes, they'd gone down the wrong road, hadn't they?
And then they decided at the last minute, for political reasons, to ramp it up. And quite frankly, the amount of difference it made in terms of the amount of money coming in was next to nil.
So why these frantic arguments then?
Well, because they're political symbols. I mean, what actually happened when Osborne wanted to take it down from 50p to 40p, there was a digging the heels in from Vince Cable and a few others and said, that's ludicrous. So what it finished up with was a 45p on condition that another few loopholes get blocked up. And in fact, a lot of the higher rate taxpayers don't pay those rates because they were able to get away with all sorts of manoeuvres to avoid the tax altogether. They were allowed under the previous government all sorts of loopholes. We had people in the city who were earning millions in reality paying less tax than their ruddy cleaners. It was absolutely farcical.
So why the big fuss over this then, Martin, if, as Gary's saying, actually people are squirreling their money away in tax havens anyway?
Well, the fact is that the 50p tax, if 50p tax is brought back in by Labour, it will bring some money in, not a lot, but some money, and it's also basically symbolic, as has been pointed out. The fact is that a lot of problems have developed over the years with what's called the Laffer curve. The Laffer curve is a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph, and the basic idea is if you put taxes up beyond a certain level, the tax take by the government gets reduced because basically people hide their taxes, evade them, or you know, or in other ways don't go out to work and earn the money. But in actual fact, I don't think there's any real evidence that that kicks in until very high levels of tax, which is why during the 1950s in US and in Britain, conservative governments had top rates of tax for 96% on the very highest earners because they needed to pay for the Korean War to stop the communists taking the money off them altogether. And of course, in those days, people really understood that that's what it's about. You either pay your money to pay for the army to stop the Chinese communists winning this, otherwise, we're going to take it all off you, just some of it.
Just to make it clear, this is for everybody that's paid a salary of over £150,000, this 50p, 45p rate of tax that they're talking about. Anyway, back to the Commons. This time, we heard, I'm not quite sure who the MP was this time, I'm afraid, because the volume was too low. But anyway, about something to do with, it was a question was about whether our recovery is just being fuelled on property prices.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. People in my constituency and up and down the country are working harder and harder just to make ends meet, as their pay is consistently outstripped by prices. Does the Prime Minister therefore agree with the Business Secretary, who said this week that a property-fuelled recovery is the wrong sort of recovery? And may I be helpful to the Prime Minister? The answer is on page 37 in his folder.
What I think you'll find, the Business Secretary said, is that it is welcome that in terms of our GDP growth, we've seen strong growth in manufacturing and industrial production and not just in services. I think that is important. In terms of making sure that we genuinely help people as our economy grows, we need to cut people's taxes. Now, the point is, we have cut people's taxes because we've made difficult decisions about public spending. Every single one of those decisions has been opposed by the party opposite. If we'd listened to them, people would have a more difficult situation with the cost of living rather than a better one.
Well, David Cameron always does seem to talk about what the wonderful things he's done with taxes, but he didn't really answer the question, Gary, which is this recovery that we're seeing, at least that's being projected by the IMF, etc., is it really just a kind of property bubble?
It's not just that, but Vince Cable is absolutely right that we have to keep a very close eye on that because, you know, inflationary growth is not helpful at all. So basically, we need to be getting the growth through real investment rather than rather.
Well, we were hearing just the other week in The Economist that Mali has greater investment rates than Britain does at the moment. It's just because investment here is very, very slack, very low. It's very difficult for businesses to borrow money from banks. And for all sorts of reasons, maybe I should ask you about this, Martin, there are different sorts of recoveries. Recovery can be coming from one part of the economy which isn't actually filtering down to the rest of us.
Well, I think Vince Cable's right to warn about this. I think there is some pickup in manufacturing. Investment is still pitifully low, and we've got a massive current account deficit of something like 5% of GDP. Now, in other words, what we're really seeing is, and also, of course, the government isn't going to reach its deficit reduction targets, which was pretty much what we said in the first place. They've decided that they're going to put it off until after the next election to reduce the deficit as much as they said they were going to do. And then, not surprisingly, if you take your foot off the brake, eventually the economy starts to pick up. And, of course, this is to do with electoral considerations. And the Help to Buy is very clearly a subsidy for middle-class families in marginal constituencies under our ridiculous electoral system. So I'm afraid that all of that is really problematic. But the really problematic thing is it's all based on money printing in the US and by the Bank of England.
Martin, we're just hearing today, actually, from the Office of National Statistics that real wages have been falling. Now, for the longest period, for at least 50 years, real wages have been falling by 2.2% a year, the longest sustained period of falling real wages in the UK ever on record.
Well, that's probably one of the reasons why measured unemployment has been going down, because it's easier to hire and fire in the British economy than it is elsewhere.
But Gary, something funny is going on, isn't it? We're being told we're in a recovery, and yet real wages are still going down and down and down. The longest period for 50 years, says the ONS, that's when they started measuring it.
One of the things that's actually quite worrying, actually, is productivity. Yeah. In that, it is easy to take people on at a low wage, without helping them with improving their skills, and get a subsidy from government in the form of the tax credits, rather than investing in those people to increase their skill levels and pay them a higher wage as a result that they can earn. And I think hopefully that will follow afterwards, but we're in a stage at the moment where cheap labour is being used, and for a highly developed economy, that is a concern.
Well, another point which was made at Prime Minister's Questions was that we've got the lowest number of new houses being built, lowest number of housing starts, technically it's called, since 1920. I mean, this is not a recovery which people are feeling on the ground. We've also got a housing crisis, a homelessness crisis still.
Well, certainly we have been pushing for investment in public sector housing. It's an obvious way forward.
But it's not happening, is it? I mean, this is the start. No. I mean, these houses will take a couple of years to be built, so this is going to be felt in a couple of years' time. There's still no recovery in housing.
I think there is some signs of an increase in the number picking up a bit from a very, very low base. But basically, you can't do it all by incentive. And I think that the original scheme in terms of boosting new build had some merit in it. I think when it got expanded to a big subsidy on everyone having a mortgage, then quite frankly, it is potentially quite dangerous, and that's why Vince Cable has been warning about it.
Well, on now to the big story of the week. In fact, an international story right around the world, in America, New Zealand, everyone's been talking about it, the flooding on the Somerset Levels.
Jeremy Brown!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the severe flooding on the Somerset Levels is causing acute distress to the people who live in that area. Will the Prime Minister give a commitment today to both take immediate action to try and clear the flood water from the Somerset Levels as soon as possible, and also to put in place a long-term plan to try and make sure that this doesn't happen again in the future?
I can give my honourable friend both of those assurances. COBRA will be meeting again this afternoon to explore what more we can do to help the villagers in the Somerset Levels. The current situation is not acceptable. I can tell him it's not currently safe to dredge in the levels, but I can confirm that dredging will start as soon as it is practical, as soon as the waters have started to come down. Now, the Environment Agency are pumping as much water as is possible, given the capacity of the rivers around the levels, but I've ordered that further high-volume pumps from the DCLG's National Reserve will be made available to increase the volume of the pumping operation as soon as there's capacity in the rivers to support that. We're urgently exploring what further help the government can give to local residents to move around, and I rule nothing out in the days ahead to get this problem sorted.
high volume pumps on their way, Gary, but it's shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, really, isn't it? I mean, they've been in this situation since Christmas time, and really nothing's been done. It's taken this media storm this week, really, to get the government to pull their fingers out.
Well, it's not since Christmas time, it's the last 20 years where there's been poor planning. And the planning needed to involve making certain that the outlet for the water was improved, so the dredging, etc., but also in terms of managing the environment further up so that the water doesn't appear in the levels quite as quickly as it does. Having said that, they're going to flood. I mean, that is absolutely inevitable, but they need to flood for a few days, a week, potentially, and then be pumped out. The problem now is that there's too much water coming into them and not enough outlet for getting rid of it, so it stays there for week after week. And we have had, possibly connected with global warming, over the last 2 months, the highest rainfall over a two-month period, I think, in living memory.
OK, well, let's hear now from the chair of the Environment Agency, who is supposed to be responsible for making sure the levels don't flood, Chris Smith.
Dredging would probably make a small difference. It's not the comprehensive answer that some people have been claiming it is. It's why we began back in October, November last year to dredge some of the particular choke points on the River Tone and the River Parrot. What's been happening, of course, is that over the course of that period, we've had a lot of pumping work going on whenever there has been flooding. We've been making sure that the water is flowing as best it can. It's our legal duty to protect life and property first. And that, in any sensible scheme of things, has to be the priority.
Well, that's Chris Smith on his £102,000 a year salary for a 3-day-a-week job. Very nice. Backtracking from what he said on Monday, Martin, which was that no dredging wasn't necessary, he's now saying it might make a slight difference. I know you don't live on the Somerset levels. You probably haven't been there over the last few weeks. But well, what are your thoughts about the way that this whole thing has been managed?
Well, it may be that there's been insufficient investment in what's required.
Well, there has been no dredging for 20 years. The locals who live down there said that they used to dredge every few years, make sure that all of the ditches were dredged in rotation, and so that this actually massively increases the capacity of these. It doesn't look very different from the surface, but you can't necessarily see all the silt that's underneath, which is actually slowing down the way that water gets back out to sea.
Well, it may be that investment hasn't taken place.
No, it hasn't, and we just have 500 job cuts in the flood management area of the Environment Agency too, which is not the greatest timing.
Well, if that's the case, then it's a false economy, isn't it? And they're now becoming, and that's becoming clear. It reminds me of the old Bob Dylan song, doesn't it? Come gather round people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
Well, anyway,
the times they are changing.
Okay, Martin, let's have a listen now to some of the locals when they were speaking on BBC Radio 5 Live earlier this week. Get their opinion.
This property we're standing in now is not insured this time round. I mean, after last year's event, we tried through the broker to get someone to insure it against flooding, and no way. It's a total loss, really, as far as we're concerned.
And the people that have got insurances, some of them, their excesses are ridiculous. One person, £35,000.
The property next door to where we are now, they have quite a large excess on their policy. So all this talk in the press and from the government about, you know, people being able to get insurance is totally false, really. Mm. It's of no use to us on the ground. The Environment Agency are peddling the same story now that they've peddled for years. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the river was dredged. This house we're standing in now did not flood until last year. The house is about 150 years old. So my wife's lived here all her life, her father before her. And the place, just water got close, you know, as far as the back garden. We're not naive enough to think the levels won't have floods, but this house has been standing here for 150 years and never flooded until last year. The Environment Agency say that they do their bit for wildlife and everything else, but they've totally forgotten about wildlife down here, I'm afraid, and the humans as well. The whole point is really that we're living in a country that's supposed to be sort of high tech. We're talking, the government talk about high speed rail track and all that entails. They can't even keep the water in the rivers.
Well, I took a trip down to the levels last weekend to just have a look at mid-tide, just to have a look at the sluices, because they have massive drains. There's King Sedgemoor Drain, Huntsville River drains a large part of the levels, not just the River Parrot, and that goes pretty much straight out to sea at Huntsville. And the Environment Agency sluice at Huntsville was actually closed at mid-tide, so that's actually keeping the water back on the levels. Now, what is going on with this Environment Agency? Because all the locals say they're hopeless. The guy that's running it, apparently, is from Northern Ireland. He doesn't know anything about the levels, and he's based in Dorchester. They can't get in touch with the Environment Agency, and when they've demanded in previous years that the dredging goes on, they say, well, we don't need to dredge. It seems it's being managed from afar, and surely the answer here is at least to involve local people, traditional people that have worked the levels over the years, in the management of the way that they're drained.
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, we've seen too much of that, not just in this particular circumstance where, you know, faceless agencies run things from on high and don't actually understand what's going on the ground. And because there's been lack of accountability, then it just carries on going without any change. Now, I mean, I think, unfortunately, you saw accountability go into overdrive when, you know, some local MPs started getting really upset about it. And then the Prime Minister runs round and says, send the army in. And the army get there and say, well, what can we do?
I don't think the army have got dredgers, have they? I'm not sure. They might.
Well, you can't use dredgers. Well, the things are actually flooding anyway.
You actually could use dredgers in the mouth of the Parrot, for example. There's no reason why not. Anyway, on to our last story. And Martin, I'm going to get you to explain this a little bit for us, which is on the Scottish referendum. King Carney, the Governor of the Bank of England from the Bank for International Settlements, that, by the way, in its old incarnation, helped finance Hitler back in the Second World War, Mark Carney warns that the Scottish pound will come at a price. He's saying an independent Scotland would have to give up a significant amount of its freedom to tax and spend if it wanted to form a currency union with the rest of the UK. The Governor of the Bank of England is warning the Scottish people, and particularly Alex Salmond at the SNP.
Well, they're trying to frighten people not to vote in favour of Scottish independence. But there is an issue here, because if you're going to be independent, you've really got to have your own currency.
So he's not giving independent advice, you think? I mean, surely that's his role.
He pipes up the other day to shoot down something that Ed Miliband had said. I mean, let's face it, he's been put in power by Osborne. What he should be doing is raising interest rates because of the property bubble, but he won't do that either. That's what he's been brought
Why
in.
Why won't he?
Because he's basically been put in not to do that. He's supposedly independent, but he's increasingly showing that he isn't. But I mean, the fact is that, I mean, he's intervening in this debate as well now. I mean, but there is a problem for the Scottish Nationalists about what kind of currency they're going to have, because in the past they'd say, well, we'll have the euro, perhaps, or we'll have, but they may have to have an independent Scottish currency, the groat or something, which might be.
But is it appropriate for
Norwegian
Mark to give advice like this? Because he's actually wading in quite a political way here, isn't he?
Well, I think that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, this independence. Central banks aren't really independent, and therefore Carney is in fact.
So, who are they working for?
Carney used to be Goldman Sachs chap.
Gary, what's your thoughts about Mark Carney's intervention here and his role generally?
Well, I think it's actually very necessary, actually, because I think if this sort of advice had been put round to a number of countries before they joined the euro, then things would have been rather better managed than they were. Because it is absolutely the case that if you want to have a currency union, you give up some of your sovereignty. Mm. Now, that's, you know, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, it is reality.
Martin, should the Scots have their own currency?
Well, I mean, if they vote for independence but keep the pound, they're not independent. This is the point that Chris is making.
Okay, folks. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Chair of Bristol City Council's Resources Scrutiny Committee and Lib Dem Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. After the news, the banks.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
from the Sky News Centre at 6. Amanda Knox says she will never willingly go back to Italy after a judge reinstated her and her boyfriend's convictions for murdering a British student. Barry Weir reports.
The pair were originally jailed for Meredith Kercher's murder in